Hi everyone and welcome to Risky Business. My name's Patrick Gray. This week's show is brought to you by Proofpoint, the cybersecurity mega corporation, best known for doing email security, but they do other stuff too, like DLP that doesn't make you want to kill yourself, so you can find them at proofpoint.com. Proofpoint's Chief Strategy Officer, Ryan Callenber, is this week's feature guest, and he takes a good old-fashioned dump on some recent vendor trends, like all these security companies trying to be platforms. What's a platform in this context? What do you mean, platform? He also walks us through some attacker behavior Proofpoint has seen lately, like attackers moving from 365 accounts into on-prem code execution, which is something Adam and I have talked about a bit on the show. That's happening more and more, so Ryan's going to join us to talk about that later on. That is coming up later, but first up, it's time for a check of the week's news headlines with Adam Boileau. G'day, mate. How are you?
Not too bad. Not too bad, Pat.
Excellent. And look, this week, there's no huge story. Like, it feels like it's been a little while since there hasn't been, like, a major ransomware operator takedown or what
Microsoft
do we have?
Getting like, owned or...
Microsoft getting owned or bad reports into Microsoft or the XE, you know, backdoor or whatever. But that's good. There's a bunch of stuff to talk about, don't get me wrong. But we're going to start by talking about some trends. And CyberCX, where you have worked for some years, have just dropped a report from their incident response group that actually makes for very interesting reading.
Yeah, it's a great crew. They respond to a lot of incidents in Australia and New Zealand, and this is their year in review. And there's a number of insights in this, which I think, especially in context of the conversation that we're going to have today, you know, kind of around where ransomware is at the moment. There's a number of insights in here. One of them was that BEC continues to rise as a real place for attackers to make money. And BEC has been a huge part and an under-recognized part because ransomware is so flashy. BEC has just been the thing that's been making a whole bunch of people.
The bucks have always been in BEC. But yeah, according to this report, among the CCX caseload, it's a 37% increase in 12 months, which is like,
oof. Yeah, exactly. That is a pretty big one. And that older MFA mechanisms, you know, earlier than pass keys or, you know, U2F style auth is being regularly bypassed by BEC actors. Which, once again, it's a thing we've been predicting and it's interesting to see it actually there in their casework. The thing that stood out to me, though, is that 50% of the victims, 50% less victims are paying ransoms. And, you know, that does bring the question, is ransomware still a way to make mad bank, you know, between the takedowns and the risks and the pressure and the costs being imposed by Western governments and law enforcement and so on, and, you know, people being less willing to pay, insurers being less willing to pay, like, is this a thing that is changing that overall calculus for them?
Maybe. I mean, 50% of a ton of money is still a ton of money.
This is true. Yes, it is still a ton of money. And also, you know, we've seen that kind of the way the ransomware ecosystem is broken up into separate access brokers and people, you know, selling onwards access into systems and a bit more diversity in the way that people are getting in. We've seen exploitation. We've seen CRED stuffing. We've seen remote access with CREDs harvested from other people. So there is, you know, it's not just shells on the edge of the network anymore or not just phishing email like it used to be a few years back.
Yeah, remote access solutions with valid credentials became the number one initial access method for cyber extortion incidents. In other words, they're just logging in.
Yeah, they're just logging in. And, you know, after all of the high profile, you know, Fortinet bugs and Citrix bugs and whatever else that got a whole bunch of people owned a couple of years back, and I'm thinking back to Excellion, for example, which was, you know, more data breach than ransomware, but, you know, still monetized by Klopp and whoever else. So seeing that kind of bug as the primary entry point seems like it's not, you know, it's not so much that these days.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think, and this is a conversation you and I had the other day, right? Where I think it really depends on the affiliate. You know, I think for an affiliate that gets access to, that reverse engineers a patch or whatever, gets themselves a timely bug, and then, you know, develops an exploit, goes out and exploits it and, you know, makes a bunch of money that way. I think it's a per affiliate kind of thing, right? It's going to come down to who's actually doing the hacking.
Yeah, like if you've got the bugs, you can absolutely go and use them and make, you know, make some bank with them. But there are plenty of other people who don't have those skills or don't have access to the bugs that are still finding ways, you know, to get in there either through buying access and just kind of making margin, basically, or using other, you know, less exciting but still workable techniques.
Now, I want to talk about Lockbit for a bit because we've noticed like over the last few weeks, look, there's still plenty of ransomware going on. There's, I think VMware gear is having a hard time at the moment and getting ransomware left and right. But Lockbit is gone, right? At least for now, Lockbit has just disappeared. And we've got this, you know, ransomlook.io/stats, which publishes a bunch of, you know, ransomware statistics. We've linked through to it in the show notes, but when you flick through this page, it's amazing when you realize just how prolific Lockbit were before the takedown. So you scroll to the bottom of this page and you see the number of listings Lockbit was doing, and it looks like a mistake on the chart.
Yeah, exactly.
And then you go and look at the 30 days and, oh, okay, they're gone. And they're just gone and the chart kind of looks normal again. Obviously, when the Lockbit takedown happened, there was all of this, you know, brouhaha with them saying, we'll be back, and, you know, standing up various hidden services and stuff and saying, you know, it's just a flesh wound. But they appear, at least for now, to be gone, which is pretty interesting. Meanwhile, there's all sorts of chaos happening with, you know, Alpha or Alfie or whatever you want to call them. You know, they got into a spat with the affiliate who ransomware Change Healthcare because the affiliate claims that, you know, Alpha just nicked off with the money. So it seems like the ransomware ecosystem is going through a bit of change right now. But a caveat here, which is, you know, we're around Orthodox Easter at the moment. So it's possible some of these groups are waiting until after they've hung out with grandma to kick their operations on again, you know.
Yeah, it's funny because we've been having this conversation back and forward for probably a solid week now in the Risky Biz Slack about, you know, whether ransomware really has dropped off a cliff, whether, you know, it's just small groups picking up, whether the size of victims has changed. We had all this kind of analysis. And then someone pointed out that actually, yeah, it might just be Orthodox Easter. And that's, you know, as you say, everybody's gone home to see Babushka and, you know, and hanging out, having compote and whatever else. It might just be that simple, but
it kind of predates Easter though. Like it's things. I don't know if we can say that it's, you know, volumes are reduced, and it really depends how you measure it. Do you measure it by number of systems ransomed? Do you measure it by payments? Do you measure it by the turnover of impacted organizations or their criticality? Right, like analyzing ransomware and seeing how it's doing as a whole. There's like 100 different ways to do it, right? Which is why often when you hear commentary on ransomware, it's all a little bit vague, kind of like what we're doing now.
Yeah, right? there's a lot of vibes and the facts can be hard to come by. But
get the sense that things are changing. I think that's the thing that we can say, right?
Yeah, and I think like the stats on ransomlook.io, you know, do show a big gap where Lockbit used to be, and the sort of, you know, the groups that are picking up the slack are a bit more scrabbly, a bit less well organized, a bit less scaled because ransomware and so we've been through an era of a number of the large ransomware groups really being at the center of everything, you know, Lockbit, Black Cat FV, et cetera, and it seems a bit more bitsy at the moment. And you know, it's going to take a while before we know whether some of the things that we have done, you know, in terms of intervention of law enforcement takedowns, et cetera, even just the effectiveness of blockchain cryptocurrency tracking and the amount of grief that brings to people, you know, like the Alf V crew being watched with their Change Healthcare ransom.
They're currently, we got some reporting here that says they're currently like throwing all that into mixes and, you know, doing their best, but good luck.
Yeah, good luck. Exactly right. It's just become, you know, there's a bunch of pressure points on that ecosystem. And I, you know, I'm hopeful that the kind of change in velocity that we're seeing is real and not just a, you know, an artifact of the holiday season.
Yeah. I mean, I think what you say about the large scale ransomware as a service platforms is right. Like, you know, who knows? Maybe the mid tiers and scrappy ones are going to be able to completely make up what we've been able to remove through those disruptions. But you do get the sense that once another one starts to get some scale, there's probably going to be a disruption action against them as well, right? And around we go. So it's still too early to say, but there are at least some signs that, okay, we're not making a comment on what it's done to the ransomware problem as a whole, but I think we can say that we've at least been able to observe an effect. In that Lockbit currently dead. Alpha exit scammed with $22 million and haven't really been seen again, which, you know, if it weren't for the pressure of these disruptions, maybe they wouldn't have done that.
Yeah, and I think back to when darknet markets were starting out, right? When Alphabay or what's the Dread Pirate?
Silk Road.
Yeah. Like back when there were, you know, one or two big marketplaces and they got, you know, a whole bunch of focus. And now, you know, that ecosystem has had to fragment to stay under the radar. There isn't really room for a Silk Road like high profile thing. And I think, you know, maybe that's the point we've got to with ransomware, is you do have to stay smaller and underground, a bit more underground, to be able to, you know, stay under the radar of law enforcement and disruption activity. And I hope that's the case.
Well, that would be a win, right?
It would. So, yeah.
I think one thing too that I just want to reflect on in wrapping all of this up is that early on when ransomware really became a crisis, there was a big response among a lot of policymakers that a big part of the solution to ransomware was going to be security uplift, right? That always seemed ridiculous to me. And I think we can definitely say if anything's changing in the ransomware like criminal ecosystem, it ain't because we got better at security.
Yeah, that's, you know, given the bugs that we've seen in enterprise edge software, you know, lately, clearly we're not solving that problem. But, you know, in the end, whatever gets the job done, right? I mean, we can't do the hard thing, which is make software good. Then maybe we could make cryptocurrency hard.
Now, on that topic, we can make software good, but only in certain circumstances, right? So we got a report here from Lorenzo over at TechCrunch, which is talks about the skyrocketing prices brokers are paying for bugs in things like, you know, iPhones and Android devices, WhatsApp, Signal, iMessage, that sort of thing. So the prices are going to the moon. This suggests to all of us, and should suggest to anyone listening, that it's getting harder to own those devices, right? And that's why the prices for these exploits are going up. Now, where I think some people make a mistake is they see this trajectory and they think that the same thing is going to happen in enterprise software, because more exploitation means more spending on QA, more spending on security reviews, tightening it up and whatnot. I disagree with that for reasons I'll get into in a moment, but why don't you start off by walking us through this this report from TechCrunch, Adam?
So this is based on a refresh of a vulnerability acquisition program by a vendor called CrowdFence, which I think are UAE based, and they buy bugs and then turn them into exploits or whatever else, and presumably sell them onwards. It's not 100% clear who they sell them to, but they're in that kind of like buy vulnerabilities, don't report them to the vendor, make money out of them business, and they have put out a new price list that basically is offering between $5 and $7 million for iPhone bugs, about $5-ish million for Android bugs, $3-ish million for Chrome and Safari and so on, which is a little above what we've seen from, say,
Zerodium.
You know, some of the other, like ZDI is not really in the same game exactly because they do report them to the vendors, but, you know, open market vulnerability buyers, this is a little higher than perhaps we've seen elsewhere. For the, you know, the more private marketplaces, these prices might even be a bit low, you know, for the sort of people selling into defense and government and places like that.
Into places where provenance is important, right?
Yes, and also where, you know, exclusivity is important and it's, you know, a much more controlled kind of marketplace. So either way, you know, regardless of the specific numbers, the point is that, you know, you talk to anyone who works in Android or iOS exploitation, you know, exploit dev, and they're all saying that like life's getting a bit hard, right? The bugs are expensive, we get paid good money, but these are not easy like they were. They're not as easy as they once were. And it's, you know, this is not really a thing you can do as an individual anymore. Like you have to have a team of researchers, you have to have all that. I mean,
it's been that way for a while. Let's be honest, you know.
Yeah, it has. But the point is, yeah, the prices are, you know, the trajectory is going in the right direction for defense.
Yes.
And if you're willing to spend, you know, 8 figures, then you can still get these bugs. But, you know, they are not cheap and easy anymore, which now, you know, is a win.
It is. But I do get the sense that some people, who, when they look at a situation like that, expect this to be the situation for your FortiGates and your, you know, all of the other crap, like payroll systems, file transfer appliances, even cloud services, right? And I think the thing that people who make these comparisons forget is that, you know, how many users does WhatsApp have? You know, a couple billion?
Yeah.
So this stuff is QA'd like you wouldn't believe. You know, the budgets involved, the teams working on this stuff, like it's critical to them to get this right. Whereas a typical bit of enterprise software, you know, you might have 5,000 customers if you're lucky. It's just a completely different scale. And while I think there's going to be progress made, I just don't expect that the average enterprise web application is going to be as robust as, you know, Signal on iOS. Like that's just apples and oranges, right?
Yeah. And I think, you know, one of the advantages that that scale brings you is the ability to collect telemetry, right? If you're Apple or Microsoft or Google, you know, you're collecting enough data to see weird edge cases. And exploitation is a super weird edge case. Like they stick out like the proverbial dogs when you start to see them, you know, in your telemetry data. Whereas if you're
you mean like the dog's proverbials.
Dog's proverbials, proverbial dogs. Yes. Like the dog's proverbials.
I was just picturing a really conspicuous dog.
Smoking a pipe, yes. Exactly. You know, like the dog's playing poker in the painting. Anyway, like that, like an enterprise, like someone like Fortinet is not really going to be collecting crash dumps from their firewalls. They may be starting to think about it now, but, you know, Apple, Microsoft, and Google have just had years of head start, and something like WhatsApp, same kind of thing. They've got that data and the ability to go look at it and the mandate to make their services better as a result. So I think, you know, that does help a lot, that kind of scale, because, you know, one telemetry pool for the entire planet for iMessage, it makes it very hard to develop an iMessage exploit because your test environment is logging you.
Yes.
Which is not the case for an appliance like a Fortinet that you can go stick on your own home lab and work on it in secret.
Well, I think you can actually disable some of that reporting for your test environments. But anyway, that's...
That's a whole other wrinkle, right, that you have to go through.
100%. 100%. Yeah. Like, you know, you cannot have an unreliable exploit in that game, right? Because as soon as, like, man, Apple have set things up, Google probably as well, where as soon as something unique happens on any device anywhere in the world... When something happens that's never happened before, a crash dump goes to someone real smart.
Yeah, exactly. And they've got that spidey sense, you know, where they can just kind of like read the tea leaves of the crash dump and be like, this looks hinky. I'm going to deploy 7 dudes to spend their next week understanding why and how. And all of a sudden your $7 million bug is wrecked.
Yes.
Which, you know, be nice if Oracle did that with their products, but you know, there's just such a scale and diversity of enterprise apps.
Well, speaking of, we've got a story here where Mandiant's published like post game on Avanti exploitation, and it turns out like there were a lot of groups getting in on Avanti ownage, right? Like, because I think all of the reporting was like, oh yeah, there's now 2 groups exploiting. And it turns out, at least according to Mandiant, it was a free for all. It was a feeding frenzy.
Yes, and some of those groups were there, you know, well ahead of public disclosure of the bugs. So clearly people have been trading some of these in the underground for a while. Lots of Chinese actors up in various Avanti businesses. But yeah, like for a vendor like Avanti, that you kind of get the impression they didn't really even understand that they were security critical until quite recently, you know, because they've, you know, acquired so many things. Like I don't imagine that what Avanti CEO Jeff Abbott, who was talking recently about overhauling the company's security practices. Like, I can't imagine he knew about Connect Secure until, you know, a few months back, because it's just one tiny product of a giant litany of things. Whereas I'm pretty sure that everybody at Apple has heard of iMessage. You know?
Yeah, I wonder if this is sort of like when I'd talk to Brad Arkin, who was then CISO of Adobe, and I think, you know, the Acrobat Reader plugin, browser plugin, was like the bane of his existence. You know, because everyone on the planet used it. And it's like, I think they spent a long time in Adobe trying to kill the browser plugin. Oh, no, it was Flash.
Yeah, trying to kill
Flash.
That's
right, Flash. Yes. Yeah. So trying to kill Flash, because it's like, it gave them nothing from a business perspective except headaches, right? Yeah. So, and everyone's like, oh, Adobe sucks, you know, Murder Flash. And they're like, we're trying. Product yeah. groups keep making it necessary for various things. Anyway,
and so many people used it. Yeah, they were really stuck in a hard place there.
But like, yeah, so I wonder if these sort of acquisitions that wind up part of big software companies, if they're going to get taken out to pasture, you know, because they're just not worth the hassle. I reckon we'll see it eventually.
Maybe that's what Broadcom's doing with VMware right now. I don't know.
they'll get their pound of flesh first. I just quickly too wanted to mention, like, you know, this is a huge problem, this crappy enterprise software now being targeted, both through exploits and through just, you know, direct cred entry and whatever and brute forcing and all sorts of stuff. You know, over the last, I don't know, year, people would have heard me saying on the show, gee, if only someone would build something that would plumb your IDP through to dynamic firewalling so that people couldn't hit your apps and your edge devices unless they were, you know, properly SSO'd, that would be really cool. It turns out someone has actually built that. They were working on it. They're Australian, and they found it really funny that we were talking about, gee, wouldn't it be nice if someone would
build a long-term risky business, which was just funny.
Yeah, Sydney-based, a couple guys from a Sydney-based company called Sol One, and, you know, they've now launched that product. It's called Knock Knock, K-N-O-C, no K on it. I'll drop a link into the show notes. My point in raising this, it's not just a shameless plug. It's that I think this is going to be more the solution to that problem, right? It's going to be less about, you know, improving the quality of the code that goes into these solutions and more about finding ways to make sure no one can touch them.
Yeah, exactly, right? The you know, I know when I started reading about Knock Knock, like the first thing I'm thinking is, oh man, I would sleep way better, you know, because I'm also risky biz sysadmin now.
You are now, yes.
I would sleep way better at night if our content management system was nowhere near the internet until post-auth. And now, thanks to Knock Knock, it is nowhere near the internet until post-auth. And I do sleep better. So, you know, it's one of those things that it's a dumb solution.
But until you realize how many uses there are.
Until you think about, all the things that it makes life better through. Like, you've already got SSO, like you've already an IDP and so on. And
you've already got a million firewalls. Yeah.
Why not just, like, why is it network reachable until you know, pre-auth? It just shouldn't be.
Especially when you've got the IDP that handles all of the SSO and that ingress thing is their problem, right? And they're pretty good at that. So when you've got this wonderful centralized ingress point, why not tie network rules to it? It works really well. So we use it for SSH and we use it for our CMS, but there's people using it for stuff like Citrix, for RDP, for SSH, like at scale. It's really cool. So I mean, I'm shamelessly plugging it. I'm going to be involved in this business. We're going to do an interview with them to go into the next edition of Snake Oilers, but you know, it's still a bit, you know, rough around the edges because it is a new product, but it's very cool. And you know, it does sound like, it's one of those things that sounds like a dumb idea until you realize just how many places you can use it. You know?
Exactly.
What else we got here? Yeah, so I've dumped a few links into the show notes looking at that. I've put in a story here from AJ Vicenz over at CyberScoop looking at Alpha's laundering of cryptocurrency, and also he's written a piece about how there's a bit of drama going on with the data that was obtained by the affiliates in the attack, because the affiliates got ripped off. So it looks like Change Healthcare paid the ransomware as a service platform, but then they ripped off the affiliate who has the data, and now they're trying to sell it, and you know, that whole thing's just a mess. John Griggs written up some stories about some ransomware attacks in New York, like local government stuff. We got a Dan Gooden piece about Missouri County declaring a state of emergency. Yeah, there's all sorts of stuff still happening. Omni Hotels and Resorts have been hit with a ransomware attack. Targus, who make the gadgets and the bags, they've had a bit of a disruption. A German database company called Genius. But it all just doesn't feel like the big ticket stuff at the moment.
It just, you know, it feels on a different scale than it was 6 months ago. And I hope that that's progress.
Yeah. Yeah. There is a ransomware gang called Muliaka, which is attacking Russian businesses as well, which is interesting. Yeah.
They seem to have like a fork of Conti that they're using in Russia to do stuff. So, you know, like, I don't know whether that's Ukraine or some friends of Ukraine, but hey, why not, right?
I mean, I did recently write a piece saying, you know, that it would be nice if it wouldn't be illegal to do this to Russian orgs using Russian ransomware, because it might get the authorities there to take things a bit more seriously. Now let's talk about this this attack on Palau. So Palau is a small country kind of around Indonesia, around that sort of neck of the woods, the Philippines, up around there. And John Grieg has done a terrific job writing this up for The Record, because apparently they were being ransomwared. They had one of their boxes locked up and there were ransom notes, but the ransom notes came from like two different ransomware crews, and it looks like it was just cover and that probably China was behind this attack.
Yeah, so politically the situation there is interesting. Palau is a pretty small island nation, like 18, 20,000 people. Like, it's really not big. And they are in a free association with the US, which kind of upsets China because it's the Pacific and, you know, China wants to be big in the Pacific. And yeah, their government got ransomed. They found like a ransom note on the printer from Lockbit. This is kind of like after Lockbit kind of got shut down. So, you know, a bit awkward there. And the Bitcoin links and the links to the like portals to go negotiate payment of ransom were all broken. And then they got other ransom notes from a group called Dragon Force, which is nominally Malaysian. But again, broken links, didn't work. You know, smells a lot like disruption using ransomware as a cover. And the attack, which, you know, locked up a number of government services, like payroll for government employees in Palau, locked them up like whilst they were announcing some commemoration of the country's free association agreement with the United States. So, you know, kind of on the nose politically, didn't really feel like legit ransomware. The government in Palau was like, we'll just write some checks for payroll because, you know, small place. So, yeah, all a bit sus. And, you know, we've certainly seen ransomware used as cover, you know, for nation state maneuvering before. So not really a surprise. But, yeah, really interesting write-up from John, because otherwise we would have, you know, this one would have gone under the radar otherwise.
Why do this, though? That's the bit that I feel like is missing here. Like, what's the objective? Is this just like punishment for them recognizing Taiwan as an independent state, or like what's the go?
Yeah, but I think, you know, part of it is, you know, China is just a bit of a bully in that region because they want to assert their power, and Palau was one of the countries that has recognized Taiwan, and they saw some attacks previously around, like when they had announced their recognition of Taiwan. So, you know, I think it's just kind of, you know, China flexing, and, you know, there's been other countries in the region that have accepted Chinese support, kind of fallen more down on China's side geopolitically. And, you know, I think this is carrot and stick. Like, someone gets investment in port infrastructure and someone gets a ransomware on their government, you know, if you don't cooperate. So it's just, you know, China kind of being a jerk.
China gonna China.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah. Now some other news, and Ilya Vichuk, who was the head of cyber for the Ukrainian SBU security service. We've had him on the show previously. I had dinner with Ilya in Washington, D.C. Last year, and he's been stood down and he is being sent to the front. He may, in fact, already be there while some investigations into his conduct are carried out, Adam.
The reporting seems to be that, and the suggestions of corruption, that he and his family were, you know, spending a bit beyond their means, had a fancy apartment in Ukraine, in Kyiv, that he couldn't really afford, and presumably there's a bunch more details underneath. There was also a nuance where like a local investigative journalist outfit in Ukraine had kind of been investigating him and other aspects of the SBU, and one of their journalists got approached while he was out at the shopping mall and basically told, you know, you need to go report to, you know, for your military services, you're, you know, not defending your country, you know, being kind of threatened with being sent to the front because they were investigating, was the allegation made by the publisher. So that's also kind of not very nice.
I mean, trying to shut down a journalist investigating you for alleged corruption by threatening to have them sent to the front, is not very nice, Adam.
Not very nice.
I would agree with that. I mean, that part of it there might be a there, there might not. I mean, obviously, we don't know. There's going to be an investigation here. But, you know, Viktor Zhura, who was one of the other big Ukrainian government cyber people, he was yeeted for corruption as well. So, I mean, it's just, this is, you know, one of those issues that Ukraine has had for a long time is a government culture that's quite permissive of corruption.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, it's pretty desperate times there for a lot of people. So you can kind of see when, you know, there's a bunch of money coming past or a bunch of things, you think, well, maybe I need to, you know, clip some of that for myself, you know, because it's such desperate, you know, the whole country is in
well,
such
and because
desperate things.
Everyone's but, doing it, which is what makes corruption so corrosive and cancerous,
yes,
right?
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, it's, yeah, it's kind of, you know, it's not nice to see because Ilya, when we've had him on the show and when you met him, you know, seemed like a pretty nice guy and seemed pretty competent.
Like, yeah, very much. Like, he's a smart dude. Like, he's a very, very smart guy. So this is very, very disappointing if it turns out to be true. I mean, we don't know, right? I looked into at the original reporting from the Ukrainian outlet that looked into this, and basically his wife has a very nice apartment in Kyiv, like really nice, and, you know, lists as her employment, you know, I'm an entrepreneur in the legal industry, and then there's no details at all on what she's doing for work. So, I mean, you know, obviously this is something that needs to be looked at. I would love it if it turned out to be incorrect, but, you know, yeah.
Yeah, you never really know when the smoke's fire, really, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah.
And it's funny too, because when we were talking about this, I was getting all judgy about it, and you kind of reminded me it's easy for me to say because I'm in a very comfortable situation. So, you know, for those of us who aren't, the temptation is greater.
Yeah, well, exactly right. And in the middle of a war zone, you know, different thing, you know, things can feel a bit different when you're, you know, you've got air raid sirens going off around you. Like, the world can be a bit different than the comfortable life that you and I lead.
Yeah, and I think the amount of money is not all that high. You know, it's something like 600,000 US or something like that that's, you know, of questionable origin, right? So it's just, yeah. Anyway, I just hope that if he is forced to step down, that they are able to find someone else, you know, as competent to take his position, right?
Yeah, well, certainly, you know, they have a lot of experience in Ukraine, and that does build competence. So, you know,
yeah,
maybe
that's
they'll
right.
find some people. But yeah, if he does end up on the front lines, then, you know, best of luck to him, because no one, you know, even if you've been a very bad person, you still don't deserve to die in trench warfare. So,
yes, well, no one really does, Adam. So you know. No. Even on both sides of that conflict, the average bloody poor conscript who's being sent to fight in Ukraine on the Russian side, I mean, it's just so pointless.
It really is, yeah.
Now, look, speaking of Russia, prosecutors there are launching a criminal case against executives of a flight booking platform. Because we covered this when it happened, right? The platform was called Leonardo, and, you know, they got owned real hard, which is, you know, bad, especially when you're in a war and then all of a sudden all of the data about who was flying where is falls into the wrong hands. That ain't good. So there's going to be, looks like a criminal case here.
Yeah, I mean, this kind of data is super useful. And, you know, we've seen outfits like Bellingcat, et cetera, make really, you know, good use of data that leaks like this. And, you know, it's embarrassing for the people whose data gets dug up and then used. So, yeah, interesting. We're going to see prosecutions. You know, I imagine the bar for sending people off to, you know, special penal colonies is not super high in Russia. So, yeah, I suspect they will face some retribution.
Yeah, so what's the actual charge? What's the allegation here that they were just doing a crap job?
According to some reporting, you know, it's basically just because they did a bad job. They got themselves owned. They got the data leaked. They did not do a good enough job, plus the scale of it. Yeah, that's basically it. Doing a bad job.
I believe they were detained, according to TASS, for allowing a cyber attack. So there you go. let's see. Oh, look, we're not even going to get involved in this. Let's not talk about it. But the 702 renewal is back again.
Again, yes. The drama keeps on going. And yeah, as you said, like, there's not, you know, we've been covering this because we, you know, it's super important piece of you know, legislation and a super important tool, but it is getting tiring, just back and forth. Like, at some point, they're going to have to decide the future of the 702 program. And yeah, blow by blow, not that exciting.
Yeah, so we've dropped a link into the show notes. Tim Starks has a write-up for CyberScoop, so you can go read in your own time, basically. Now let's talk about this D-Link thing. D-Link has said people should sunset these particular storage devices that have an all-timer bug in them. Just fantastic, fabulous stuff. Terrific engineering. But they've said they should retire them,
yes.
Which is code for please yeet these things into a log chipper post-haste. Walk us through this, because it sounds like what was the bug? It was like a high-priv user with no password or something?
So it's a web-accessible interface that has the user message bus and the password of nothing. And at that point, you can leverage that up into command exec on the device. It's kind of chained with another bug. But yeah, that's the guts of it, which is super embarrassing. This is their like NAS appliances, which you probably shouldn't put on the internet in the first place. But yeah. End of life.
You know, I used to say that, right? Because I got a Synology, and I used to say that about the Synology ones. And I'm like, who the hell puts these on the internet? And what I didn't realize is there had been a software update that when you set it up, it automatically puts it out there on like a dynamic DNS so that you can access it. So many of these NAS things, which are like, oh, don't put them on the internet. When you go through the setup wizard, that's exactly what they do. Yeah, I don't know if this one
UPnP does. Or they UPnP a hole on the firewall or something. Yeah, like they want to make themselves reachable. So yeah, don't do that. And if you have a D-Link, you probably want to go check this stuff because we are seeing widespread exploitation. Some of the numbers we had seen early on in this were like 100,000 of these on the internet. I saw an update from Grey Noise where they said that actually vulnerable boxes is probably more like 5,000. So it's a bit smaller than was originally reported, but still a big deal for the people whose stuff's on those NASs.
Yeah, Grey Noise checked with Census, I think, and said, no, there's 5,000 of these, which is, you know what's real funny is because I was talking about that one with Tom a couple of days ago. He's like, yeah, there's 90,000 of these out there. And I'm like, are you sure? Like, that just, like, it didn't sound right. So when you dug up that new number, I was like, okay, that sounds more like it.
Yeah, makes a bit more sense. But yeah, either way, dealing stuff bare on the internet, not going to have a good time.
No. Now, walk us through Andy Greenberg's latest for Wired.
Yeah, so this is a story about a guy called Alejandro Caceres, who's a Colombian-American, lives in Florida, and is a hacker who's been doing all sorts of security stuff for a while. And this story talks about his journey of becoming like an internet vigilante against North Korea. So he got tricked by one of those North Korean scams where they say, like, hey, we want to collaborate with you on some security research, you know, on GitHub or wherever, send you a backdoor binary and then show you a box. He ran the backdoor binary, but in a, you know, controlled environment, a VMware or whatever, so he didn't get hacked. But he got rather salty about it and decided to take it out on North Korea. So
As you do.
So he was, you know, hacking stuff on the North Korean perimeter. He was DOSing stuff to take out North Korea's internet and, you know, generally going on a vigilante spree, which... You know, you would expect that that's not a necessarily reasonable solution to that particular problem, not an effective solution to the problem. But then the journey goes into a strange place where he ends up having some buddies that are working in the Pentagon or involved in the, you know, military industrial complex, and they're really interested in what he's been doing. And so Andy writes up this guy's journey of, you know, trying to convince American, you know, military and cyber forces to be a bit more proactive, a bit more YOLO, a bit more shell slinging. Out there on the internet making trouble for people, you know, in
similar vein
to the sort of things that we've said with Hound Release, but maybe a little more YOLO. But it's a great story to read. And, you know, I don't 100% agree with all of his logic. You know, there's sometimes considerations about just shelling stuff that, that you should have in mind. But it's hard not to like a guy that's just like, you know what? I would just go shell some things, RM some things, you know, tear up other people's internet. What are you going to do about it?
Indeed.
So, yeah, good read.
Fun stuff. All right, so now we're going to talk about something that's way over my head. We're going to talk about disrupting teas with malicious notifications, Adam. What on earth is this? This is very complex. There's a lot of acronyms. I don't really understand it. Please help.
So we've got two stories to talk about today. We've got both of which are in the like CPU microarchitectural bugs category from academics. One is this set of attacks they called Ahoy, which is, comes out of ETH Zurich. And essentially this is a mechanism for breaking... So there's a way that you can run virtual machines on hardware you don't trust. So when you put stuff in the cloud, normally you have to trust your cloud provider to not mess with your stuff, not look at what your machine is doing and steal your intellectual property or train their machine learning on your data or whatever else. And so the hardware vendors have been starting to build ways for you to run confidential VMs, virtual machines where the hypervisor can be untrusted and you can still do work on that hardware, you know, without it being visible to the operator of the cloud. And that's the thing. The more stuff we put in the cloud, the more, mostly compliance people, let's be honest, are going to want to see some kind of checkbox that says your data is protected from the cloud vendor. Ultimately, you probably still have to trust them, but we've got technical controls for doing virtual machines that are, you know, safe from, confidential from the hypervisor itself. And both Intel and AMD have mechanisms to implement this in hardware. And this is two attacks from ETH Zurich that break that boundary, that allow a hypervisor to control the runtime state of confidential virtual machines, in this case through the delivery of interrupts in a crafted manner. And the specifics of exactly how that works is really interesting, but not super important. The main thing is that this confidential VM tech is still imperfect.
I'm just thinking, sitting here while you're explaining this, thinking how remarkable is it that we could even think that this could be a boundary?
Right? Yeah, it is. It's amazing that that's a boundary that we've started to think about implementing.
Yeah, I mean, we used to say, remember, physical access always wins.
Yes.
Now it doesn't, right? And you know, certainly, I mean, it's very, very hard, right? Physical access doesn't always win. And now it's like, well, okay, you got like hardware level access and you're able to protect a VM from that somehow, like that
it's pretty wild, Like we've come a long way, from Microsoft saying if you have physical access to the computers, you win, to now we have Apple phones that, can defeat law enforcement control of the device, need bugs to get into that. And now we've got, this being similar with confidential VMs. And the tricks that they're using are pretty cunning in actually making them work, which they have done. But overall, I think, if you were designing a platform to implement confidential computing in an unsecured hypervisor that wasn't legacy x86, or x64, like traditional architectures, I don't know that you would have made the mistakes that allowed these things to work. So we're still, because we're building it on old tech, I think is the ultimate root cause here. And in the future, we will have more robust systems for doing this kind of thing. So I don't know that a lot of people use confidential VMs or rely on them for a security critical purpose and really need to defend against their hypervisor, but it is super interesting research nevertheless.
Now, is that both of them?
So there's two bugs in this category of confidential VMs. The other hardware microarchitectural bug I wanted to talk about is some research from VUSEC, which is essentially an improvement on one of the Spectre variants. So it's a microarchitectural side channel that lets you leak data between processes inside a single machine. So if you're a non-root user, being able to steal things from root, like passwords or whatever, to escalate access. And this is some research into basically advancing the state of the art. They're using symbolic execution to find gadgets that can implement cache side channels in the branch predictor. So we've seen branch prediction side channels before, and the main way that people were exploiting that previously was using eBPF, which is like in a Linux environment is a kernel system for doing inspection of the runtime environment. So you can build kind of complicated software that runs in the kernel and changes behavior. This is a case of doing it without that as their main advance in this piece of research. So overall net result is a yet another microarchitectural data leaking side channel that lets you prevesc inside your machines. And great research, pushing the state of the art, et cetera, et cetera. We'll pay for it with performance hits and more checks as usual, and get on with our lives.
Yeah. But I think the thing that comes across to me here is, first of all, amazing research. But second of all, like, what incredible engineering to be able to even research, right?
Yes, yeah, no, it really is. It's pretty cool.
Computers, huh? Computers, yeah. They're amazing.
They are wild.
I think you sent me a quote from an Intel document that I don't even know which one of those two it pertains to, but I think you sent this to me because it is so indecipherable, which is Intel recommends continuing to enable both SMEP and EIBRS by default and using IBPB on context switches where needed. Glad they could clear that up.
Exactly. Oh, dear.
Now, I just want to finish with something very funny. And I saw this kicking around, and Lorenzo actually wrote it up for TechCrunch, so we've linked through to TechCrunch. But there was a recording of a phone call between a ransomware operator, apparently from like Dragon Force, which is a ransomware group.
Ringing up the that claimed the Palau attack.
Yes, yes. Apparently Malaysia-based, I think.
Yeah.
Is that right? Yeah.
Yeah.
So someone claiming to be from Dragon Force rings up a victim company. You know, I want to speak to management, you know, trying to do the big spooky hacker thing, winds up getting put through to someone in HR, and the resulting conversation, which has been mostly transcribed here, reads like it's from a comedy sketch. It is so funny. This is like if you wanted to make a satirical like sitcom about ransomware, this would be it.
Yeah, like it is just so funny, and you can see the ransomware guy getting more and more exasperated with the response from the person in HR, who really, you know, is doing their best, but really has very little idea what's going on or what to do about it.
Yeah, he's like calling from Dragon Force, and she's like, "So is that like Dragonforce.com or
Dragon Force the band, maybe?"
and my favorite part is too where the attacker says that they recorded a previous conversation. They're like, yeah, you're not allowed to do that in Ohio. It's a two-party consent state, you know. That's illegal.
And the person says, ma'am, I am a hacker. I don't care about the law.
Yeah, and I love how she ends the call, which is saying, all right, well, then I'm just going to go ahead and end this phone call now. I think we've spent enough time and energy on this. Good luck, you know, click. Anyway, have a read of it. It's
good comedy. Good comedy.
It is. That is it for the news, Adam. Thank you so much for joining me, and we'll do it all again next week.
Yeah, thanks so much, Pat. I will talk to you then.
That was Adam Boileau there with a check of the week's security news. It is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Ryan Callumber, the Chief Strategy Officer at Proofpoint. And Ryan has a bee in his bonnet. His jimmies are rustled. He is a cybersecurity executive at a major vendor who is displeased with other cybersecurity executives at other major vendors. That's right. He's going to have a bit of a rant about why everyone needs to stop calling their products platforms. And after that, he's going to talk about how attackers are moving. I don't even know how you would say this. They're moving laterally down, up. They're moving from compromised 365 accounts to on-prem code exec via things like Intune enrollments and, you know, using their 365 access to do things like download pre-configured Zscaler clients and whatnot. So, you know, that's the nightmare scenario that Adam and I have been talking about for a while. But we will start here with Ryan rubbing his temples at some recent trends in the security market. And you'll hear Adam in this interview too, because he was around for this one. Enjoy.
I don't know that anyone has a consistently agreed upon definition of what a platform is, but it's like the famous Supreme Court case. You know it when you see it. And several vendors are out there more or less making the case that, well, our stuff is integrated. There's a single data layer. Therefore, we are a platform. And these other things, even if you can buy them with one SKU and they have one name, they're not actually a platform.
And they're not actually integrated.
They're not actually integrated. Because, you know, one of the things that I think has become really interesting is that regardless of where you started, whether you started on the endpoint, whether you started on the network, whether you started like us in email, a lot of people got really in love with being a data layer, trying to put insight together and trying to pull in things from other sources, trying to put together timelines and normalize data from all kinds of different places and put it together in a single layer, which starts to feel a bit like a platform. But obviously,
everything logging to the same place. And then, you know, presenting that data via a web app that, you know, just accesses that data pool. I mean, that's not really what integration means, is it?
Correct. It's also not remotely a new idea. And ultimately...
Single pane of glass. You got to say the words that make the hamster hit the pedal. Single pane of glass.
I was waiting for you to say it before I did. But now it's an AI-powered single pane of glass.
Yeah.
And ultimately, when you think about it, what you actually want out of a security tool, even if it's solving multiple things for you, it's an outcome, right? It is preventing, stopping the bad thing from happening. It's not a giant pile of data that you then have to go do something with, because even the biggest security organizations at this point, they don't have the people to do it. They don't have the engineering talent to integrate these pieces. And I realize I'm making the exact same argument that a lot of the people positioning platforms are making, but I think it's actually a philosophical problem on the vendor side, that we're not trying to solve problems in their entirety and deliver an outcome, but rather trying to create one platform to rule them all.
Yeah.
That becomes a data layer.
Well, I think one of the reasons behind this is that these companies, particularly the EDR companies, are just so cashed up now, and they've got to do something, and this is something, right? So yes. So just get more and more data in, because they're good at managing large volumes of data, right? So they just get more and more data in, and hey, we're the next Splunk. Like, that seems to be the thinking. But you're right in that all of the large vendors seem to think that what everybody wants is all of their data in one place, right?
Yeah, it's the XDR pitch, right?
Yeah. You know,
whatever detection and response. And we've actually started to think about all of the problems that we're trying to solve differently. You know, DLP is a great example of something that used to be just a giant pile of alerts, and then you'd try to do clever things to make the pile smaller or intelligently handle some of these pieces. If you're properly thinking about the problem, though, you should plummet all the way through to what the end user does and try and make sure that anything that bleeds over into the SOC is an exception of an exception and actually worth somebody putting eyes on glass for. On the threat side of our business, maybe we're just a little in love with threat intel. I certainly am, completely guilty of this. I love looking at actor attribution. I love looking at campaign details. I find that the vast majority of security organizations, maybe if they had all the time in the world, they would do that. But they don't, because, again, it's not really their job. And
yeah, we could have a long conversation about this file hash, but we actually have shit to do.
Exactly. Exactly. The Zoom meeting will not attend itself. And so ultimately, if you're doing it right, you solve the problem you're supposed to solve, which in our case is, in that particular example, do not deliver the bad things to the people. Whether it's a BEC attack, it's malware, credential fish, pure social engineering, all of those things are things that if you do it perfectly, never hits an inbox, never hits the Graph API, never hits anything that can intersect with a person. So we've actually changed a lot of what we've been doing behind the scenes on the engineering side, not to squeeze more threat intel out of interesting payloads, but to get the detection done as far left as possible. So it's all pre-delivery. It's not something that kicks off a response workflow, like, hey, reset that cred, that person clicked on that link, they were allowed through to it, but we, of course, can lock it and kill all the active session tokens. It's much more about solving that problem holistically so that nobody has to do anything except possibly the end user.
I mean, we were talking about this before we got rolling, and you know, I was just saying when we were having the initial discussion about this, this is exactly why I'm such a big fan of Airlock Digital. You know, allow listing, right? Because you just, you know, there's so much you don't have to do at that point. You're not even generating the alerts.
Totally. And phishing resistant authentication, another great example of a thing in that
category. Airlock and YubiKeys for everybody, man, you're in such a good place. Like when it comes to all things Windows, and then you're just going to get like owned sideways by all the rotting, you know, corpses at the edge of your network with Fortinet written on them, you know.
Yes, absolutely. Steel belted radius for the win. That was my favorite piece of lore. But the other side of that, though, I think is actually interesting, though, is that what is left at that point, right? And the creative ways to try and solve those problems. Feel like we're actually filling out the entire bingo card of Risky Biz sponsors, but, you know, think about canaries at that point. And obviously, we've tried to take an approach like that to identity risk, you know, understanding what attack paths look like very much like the SpectroOps guys do, and then using things like deception so that you do not have to configure a million alerts in Splunk or whatever your data layer is to alert on the attack paths that you know will still exist because you can't fix them because Active Directory is Active Directory and Azure AD is Entra ID. But the part of that that I think has actually gotten interesting for us is when you have a solution like that, And again, it's not the main thing that we position for people, but we think it is a really useful control to have deception in place, because most attackers don't know they're up against that. And if you're just running Bloodhound against AD, you know, you're going to run into a canary pretty quickly if you're in an environment that we protect. But in a lot of organizations, they're not going to have a live attacker in there very often at all. So maybe once a year you catch the red team, but that same product is not generating a pile of alerts on a regular basis. So even our ROI models, all of the ways that people try and figure out this security product is worth continuing to pay for and maintain because all of this overhead that comes along with it, it doesn't really work with some of those controls.
Look, this is your long way of saying, CrowdStrike, what are you doing? What are you doing? Palo Alto, what you do?
It is. Those are both great questions. What they do is something that I'm not particularly qualified to answer. And yes, we'll continue integrating with both CrowdStrike and Palo Alto.
You're good friends. Yes. I said it. You didn't say it. It's fine. Everything's fine.
But ultimately, I do think it is a weird conversation to have to talk about what platformization, frankly, should not exist as a word in the English language. But
well, it doesn't, thankfully. So you don't have to worry about that. Go on.
but it also shouldn't be kind of the driving topic for security vendors when they think about their own strategies.
Yeah.
It really should be, how do you solve that entire problem? And how do you make sure that you're not dependent on bodies?
How do you instead create products which do not necessitate the creation of a data lake, I think, is the statement that we can end that part of the discussion with. That's the question, really. How can you do that? Maybe we should focus on that. Now, look, you and I had a chat a couple of weeks ago, and you said, hey, that thing that you've been saying on the show that you think is coming, which is people going from a compromised 365 account to on-prem code execution through some sort of interesting path, you're seeing that in the wild. From what you told me, this is mostly red teams doing it and APT groups. It's not criminals yet, but we always, you know, we know how that goes, right? What exactly are you seeing? And then I'm going to hand it over to Adam to ask you the more interesting questions on this, because he knows this stuff a lot better than I do.
Yeah, absolutely. So just to put this in context, when we're talking about malicious OAuth apps, we mostly see boring ones. The vast majority of them are cleverly disguised as something called test app, or sometimes they're lazy and they don't even rename the default and it's just called app. And they tend to be things like...
Oh, the app. A lot of people use that.
Hiding in plain sight. But again, it's just a classic kind of post-compromise move for an attacker who has a session token, right? Like if you use any of these normal MSA-capable fish kits these days, you're logged into M365. You're probably not super privileged, but in most tenants, it's a setting that's on to be able to create apps. And that's something that we've seen very, very frequently. It's actually more common now even than the types of OAuth apps that we would consider actually malware. Because ultimately, you know, those are easy to find and squash, and there's not that many of them. And it's kind of a permutation of the App Store problem, although I guess it's closer to the Google Android ecosystem version of that versus the Apple iOS.
Anyone can be an app store.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. What could possibly go wrong? and so most of that for us is still kind of in the world of what we would call small crime or BEC actors, right? That's the people that love to just live in M365. They don't have goals beyond that. What has become much more interesting, to your point though, is attackers who want to do kind of a variation on, I guess we're going to call them Midnight Blizzard. We would call them TA-421, the Russian intelligence attack on Microsoft, where they turned one compromised account in an M365 tenant into something that was much more interesting and access that was much broader. That's all possible, of course, and it's very challenging to monitor for in most environments unless you are looking at some of the purview audit logs. Most of this, you know, some of it's in Graph API, not all of it. So it's even a bit of a logging and monitoring challenge if you're even trying to see it, which is something that is not trivial to deal with either from our perspective, where we're trying to do this for thousands of organizations, or even on the level of an individual organization trying to defend one M365 tenant.
So I think the irony of this conversation, the previous one and then the segue into this one, is that correlating logs in one big lake between your on-prem environment and your cloud environment is one of the things you need to be able to do to spot attackers migrating through from on-prem to cloud or cloud back into on-prem. And the way that we've done that in the past, you know, working with, say, emails, for example, that classic attack of being able to set Outlook mail rules via the web interface for Exchange was a thing, you know, very early path for turning internet access into on-prem access. What kind of things are you seeing other than, you know, the traditional OAuth tokens and, you know, some of the older email techniques? Like, what else are we seeing for cloud to on-prem?
It's a great question. And you're right. I don't know, Adam, if you're suggesting we build a platform to handle this, but yes, it is definitely a monitoring challenge. And we had to basically put two different sources of log information together in order to get just the basic vanilla visibility, which to your point, really kind of shows up in three different event types. You know, one is absolutely still inbox rule creation. As depressing as that is in 2024, that is still one of our highest fidelity signals.
Yes.
Because most users either have forgotten how to do it or never did it to begin with. And so it actually turns out to be something that is almost always worth looking at, especially if you get an odd looking login that you can associate that with a new ISP, a new ASN, like just the obvious stuff that you'd be looking for that. Moving into the prem infrastructure, I think is more interesting because that's going to be, in a lot of cases, dependent on some configurations. Password sync was one of the obvious ones.
Yeah.
Again, this stuff is known. It's not new. It's just, I suppose that it's being used a little bit more frequently by attackers who know what they're doing that are also trying to start in a more unusual place. It is, at this point, kind of easy to compromise a Microsoft 365 account. I'm continually stunned that even in our customer base, which is some of the most paranoid organizations on the planet, any given month, over 50% of them will have at least one compromised M365 account. So just by virtue of having that starting place, figuring out what the Azure settings look like and then possible paths to go on, they almost always go through a relatively narrow set of routes, but we have seen basically two. Again, that password sync one, trying to get to things that can talk to the domain controller. And then the other side of that is just going after Intune itself and looking at kind of the application side. Because very often, you know, Intune can be set up, I think, in an extremely secure way. Very often, it's not. And lots of people have abilities to do different things in Intune. And those, in some cases, are almost unbounded. At that point, a lot of the red team exercises stop, though, because you're outside your scope at that point.
So you're saying they basically pivot around until they find an account that has sort of rights in Intune, and then off they go and code exec.
Yes, or in some cases, we have seen actually already the permutation from APT29 or TA421, where they're just looking for other OAuth apps and, you know, doing things like creating service principles. I think obviously your interview with was Andy from SpectreOps was great at breaking that down. That is another thing where some of those OAuth apps are incredibly powerful. The one in question obviously was basically Global Admin, but there are others that have on-premises abilities too, because again, it's just an application and it's basically domain joined. And when you have a hybrid infrastructure like that, there are these trust relationships, which are very difficult to model and very difficult to predict how.
I mean, who doesn't want to deploy an OAuth app into their 365 environment that has code execution privileges on their domain controller? I mean, I, for one, think that's a terrific idea. But look, it is 2024. I'm sure someone has done that, and I'm sure at least one person has done it with a good reason. Which it pains me to say, but I'm guessing at least one person out there did that, and there was a reason.
Yeah, and the part that is really tricky there is maybe we have data for thousands of organizations on which OAuth apps they're even running. Sometimes it's a little bit tricky to even figure out what permissions they have because there's not a really simple way to just understand that. Even kind of like read-write access and the really, really powerful ones that they have, it's not anywhere in a GUI. It's not anywhere that's just easily gettable, even if you suck down a lot of those logs. To Adam's point earlier, right, you do want to actually have as much of that visibility as possible. But it's entirely possible this is well beyond my knowledge of how EnterID's portal works at this point in time. But figuring out, you know, give me every OAuth app and its permissions, non-trivial exercise.
Well, I think Ryan, the problem is that nobody really knows how that portal works, right?
Exactly. Yeah, Microsoft's building it whilst we all attempt to understand it, and you know, I don't know that even Microsoft knows how it works anymore.
They are the Boeing of technology, really. They're you know, building the plane while they're flying it. I don't know. There's some better metaphor in there anyway. But look, Ryan, we're out of time. That was all very interesting stuff, mate. Great to chat to you again, and yeah, we'll speak to you soon.
Always a pleasure, Pat and Adam.
Thanks, Ryan.
That was Ryan Callumba there with this week's sponsor interview. Big thanks to him for that. And that is it for this week's show. I do hope you enjoyed it. I'll be back in a couple of days with a surprise mystery podcast for you all. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.